say.
You should begin talking.
Yeah. I'm beginning. Thank you, Ezra. I'm Eve Fairbanks of the New Republic magazine, and I'm
here. And I'm Ezra Klein of the American Prospect.
Hi, Ezra.
How's it going, Eve?
I apologize, Ezra, in advance for any bumps, womps, or loud noises. The office next to us caught fire over the weekend.
Really?
Yes.
What's funny about that is that, speaking of bumps, womps, and loud noises, I'm looking at my little QuickTime recording here, and like there are all these halos around the lights, so it basically looks like I am coming to you from the house I used in Poltergeist.
Poltergeist.
So things begin
right?
flying behind me or anything like that. Don't be alarmed. He's very friendly.
I won't be alarmed. Perhaps you're coming from the heavenly region of hot everyday males.
Ooh,
just kidding. I know.
Hey, as my friends have been putting it, I'm only one less hot than Nate Silver, sort of thing, and only one,
and what
and one
Rob
more than the
Emanuel.
Guy who showed his crack on national TV. So,
true.
You can't get too much of an ego when you're one above the guy who peered between his legs on a national on national theaters.
Wow. I couldn't have put it better. speaking of your ego,
I brought it up.
It's true. I wanted to start and see what you thought. I read yesterday, I get the Washington Post delivered at my house, and opened it up to see David Corn moaning and kvetching about how the liberal backlash against Obama has begun. I think that was the Politico.com provocative Politico headline for the day today. He's not happy with the appointments. He thinks... if you're a real progressive, you ought to be fit to be tied. So what do you think? Are you angry? I mean, we now have, you know, things are starting to come into place. And I guess his point was that, especially on the economic team, this is, A, more centrist group than what he would have hoped for, and, B, populated with people who, you know, aren't representing change but rather continuity with people like Tim Geithner or Larry Summers and people who he perceives to be responsible for some of the mess that Obama now has to dig us out of. Thoughts,
you know, I really wish I were. I wish I were much more unhappy, because I think I could get like a lot of good op-ed deals out of that. And I don't mean that. I don't mean to suggest that people are unhappy or are being disingenuous about it. It's shocking how much media interest there is right now in progressives who are pissed off. Like, I've gotten inquiries, people I know have gotten inquiries, but...
Really?
I mean, honestly, oh yeah, it's huge. I mean, it's a storyline people are really interested in playing out, and frankly, there's been fairly little outrage. I mean, even David's op-ed, I thought, was very sort of usefully measured. I thought he made a lot of good points, and, you know, he at the end of it, said, a lot of this looks a little weird, and it'd be good if there were some more sort of forthright liberals in these meetings. I think that the first one we really saw was Jared Bernstein of EPI, who was just named to be Joe Biden's senior economist and economic policy advisor, but the sort of operational role will be being in all sort of high-level economic meetings. But, I mean, I guess I would say two things. The one is the only appointment that I thought was a surprise was Hillary Clinton. Getting on Barack Obama, whose economic advisor was Austin Goolsbee, and whose economic policy director was Jason Furman, for hiring people of that ilk, just sort of strikes me as having not paid attention. I mean, the guy telegraphed this very, very clearly, where he is on economics. And I think that he has constructed an entirely predictable economics team. He was listening to Larry Summers during the campaign. I mean, these were really things that people could have predicted. And I'm sort of surprised to see a lot of the outrage coming from people who were with Barack Obama in the primaries. If you wanted leftier economists, you should have gone with Edwards or tried to bring someone else up. But I think that Obama's been sort of offering what he promised, which I think is a break from foreign policy, where I think there are very, very few Obama supporters who, looking at the evidence, would have said Hillary Clinton is going to be a Secretary of State. And I would just make one more quick point, which is that I think there's a sort of implicit argument about the Clinton years in the Obama picks, which I think is somewhat compelling, if not necessarily a sure thing, which is the liberal critique of the Clinton administration was that they sort of failed, particularly in the second term, but even before that, because they were too accommodationist, too incrementalist, too quick to compromise.
Triangulation, right, exactly.
And the Obama team seems to be saying something a little bit different, which is that the great failure of the Clinton years was that they couldn't get it done. That they came in and they had an inexperienced team of people who didn't know how to work the government. And they came in and they had a huge failure on healthcare reform. And from that failure, they lost a lot of seats. I mean, there were other reasons too, but that was part of it. And ended up playing a sort of rearguard game for many years. And this has sort of always been in Obama's talks. I did a piece with my colleague Dana Goldstein a while back called It's His Party. And the conclusion of the piece, which looked at during the campaign how many of his people were sort of, you know, old hands from the congressional wing of the party, not change, not new people. You know, how much, if you actually read his rhetoric on change, he would talk about actually getting things done. That change was set up in opposition to gridlock and ineffective government. And I think these picks reflect something like that policy. I think that's in many ways a positive thing. I think that he sort of decided that if he can get the people who can get policy accomplishments through, that that was a failure of the Clinton years, and that competence will do more for a progressive ideology than ideology will. Now, whether that proves to be true or not, I think it remains to be seen.
I think our conversation right now would make Bill Clinton very happy to think that Obama's cause d'etre and the beginning of his administration is to make an argument about the Clinton years. But I think you make a good point. I mean, I mean, we should just brush on Hillary, not that she hasn't been talked over a bunch, but you know, this idea that it was the these big kind of lefties, liberals that brought Obama to the dance, as I think David Corn put it, and then, or he said, should we think, you know, that the lefties brought Obama to the dance, and now he's abandoning them in favor of these centrists and Rahm and whatever and Clinton triangulators and I think back to this Cass Sunstein article. Did you read it? He wrote a few really great articles for TNR and for other places on kind of Obama's governing philosophy. And obviously, he's like a huge Obama admirer to the nth degree, and he's part of like an Obama-facilitated couple, which is the schmoopiest thing ever. So, you know, he's in a position to believe, you know, to believe the best about Obama's choices. But he wrote this article for us called The Visionary Minimalist, and it talked about a bunch of things about the ways in which Obama was conservative and the ways in which he was pragmatic. This was like a year ago. And I remember one line that that I thought was interesting, which is that when people, even like a year ago, people were sort of complaining about various things Obama did that were reaching out, you know, too much to Republicans or giving them too much of the benefit of the doubt and too centrist and too shaded and too you know, cautious, blah, 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 or whatever. And including, for one example, I believe that Obama softened the abortion section, rhetoric on his website after receiving an email from a pro-life doctor. And some people are like, this isn't change. We want change from the Bush years means change towards the left or change towards change from the right to the left, from red to blue. And Cass wrote that for Obama, reconciliation is change, so that in a certain way, like some of these, you know, people who were considered, and I think that speaks to the Hillary thing too. I mean, I think Obama has such like a Lincolnian sort of with mercy towards all and charity towards all, you know, fantasy that he's living out. And for him, kind of bringing in people who have experience from other viewpoints that are not his own, from political wings that are not his own, but whose intentions and fundamental good motivations he trusts is like, that's almost, I mean, I think that he gets like a huge high from that. So, you know, yeah, go ahead.
You know, it's funny. I think everybody has a sort of Rosetta Stone article for Obama. And I disagreed with Cass's article, which I thought made a lot of – which made some good points nevertheless. And I've been a big fan of to plug us, Mark Schmidt's article called Obama's Theory of Change. And actually, Steve Hildebrand this morning came out and like
– I'm ashamed to say, but
– Huh?
Go ahead.
What? Sorry. Steve Hildebrand wrote this piece today sort of attacking – not attacking, but defending Obama from the progressive critics, right? And he did this sort of weird thing where he said you know, listen, like, the liberals may have to wait a bit. Right now, Obama has to sort of be president of the country, which means health care and global warming and the war in Iraq and all these things which traditionally were sort of the liberal agenda. And I thought it was interesting, and it reminded me of Mark's piece. And I hear what you're saying, that Obama thinks reconciliation to be change in and of itself, right? And I think there's probably truth to that, but Mark sort of comes out of a background where he dealt with a lot of community organizers, and he had...
I think Gail Collins had the line, too, like, when Obama talks about coming together, where do you think that this coming together was going to happen? Left field, right? You know, it's a sort of...
Right,
that's
it's
the
something
argument,
like that.
But go
well,
ahead.
Mark always sort of, Mark put it as a sort of, like, almost a hard-nosed tactic. He said, you know, look, I appreciate the conflictual nature of politics. I don't think there's cross-partisan truth. I think that the liberals write on things. But imagine I weren't a magazine editor. Instead, I was a guy running for president. So what do I do with that knowledge? Imagine I'm not cynical about it, or imagine I'm not naive about power. What do I do with that? Well, I try to subvert it. And he said, one way to deal with bad faith opposition is to draw the person in, to treat them as if they were operating in good faith, and draw them into a conversation about how they would solve the problem. If they have nothing, it shows. That's not a tactic of bipartisan Washington idealists, he wrote. It's a hard-nosed tactic of community organizers who are acutely aware of power and conflict. It's how you deal with people with intractable demands. You put them on a committee. Then you define the committee's mission your way. And it always struck me as a good point. You know, it could be one or the other. It could actually be both. I mean, it could be that the tactic simultaneously actually does get things done, as Schmidt is saying, and does sort of promote a certain level of reconciliation, as Cass is arguing. But it was an article that I always thought cast it in a new light, because one thing you did get the feeling of for the campaign, I mean, this guy had to realize how deep the opposition could be. And I sort of have trouble believing that he's just out for reconciliation, but unaware of how intractable some of the opposition to him will end up proving, and that his sort of attempt to bring whoever can be brought over and use them as pawns in his game, it may be very wise, or it may be sort of wishful thinking on the part of liberals. I think it's hard to say at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think Hillary will be the huge test case of that, in a way, you know. It's sort of like he's trying to make her his steward, and just don't know if the circumstances will allow that to happen. That's an interesting idea. I mean, Obama has, not to like be a two-man PR team for him, but strikes me as someone who, more than some people, I don't know exactly how to put this, but recognizes like the ways in which certain of his actions can simultaneously appeal to like multiple groups for different reasons. So you have this call towards reconciliation, and obviously that unlocked something, some desire that was like incredibly powerful within the public. And I think that came from, you could call it an idealist, or, and I don't mean to say that pejoratively, or as kind of sentimental place, or just this sort of sense. It's the part from his speech, the in the blue states we worship an awesome God, in the red states we have a friend who's gay, like this kind of thing. I think that that very basic call towards like the sort of, yes, let's all play together, we all have good intentions, none of us are malevolent, or, you know, we all have the interests of the nation at heart, sort of call for reconciliation was very powerful in like the context of reaching out to the greater public or the demos. But then you also have like, it also plays this dual role in that, you know, you have a sort of slightly more Machiavellian, like wily, like, you know, you're going to have to join my team, and you think that you're going to be able to marionette me, but I might be the one who ends up marionetting you and kind of bending you to my will, you know?
No,
it's
absolutely true.
I have to assume, you know, I don't want to get into a litigating Hillary's motivation or her, what does Hillary want, her deepest, darkest, you know, soul. But you know, I think she obviously believes that being in this role can, I don't know that she's like desperate to help the Obama presidency go down in the history books, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? She thinks that, you know, she wants to do with something with it from her own perspective, not necessarily just to burnish her own image in, like, a gross way, but you know, I don't think she particularly trusts Obama or thinks that, you know, he's as fabulous a politician as. But she's joining on because of the opportunity it gives her, and obviously he thinks that that it's going to be, in fact, an opportunity for him, and maybe it'll be both. That's what you can hope.
I think that's true, and I think I'd amend it or add to it by saying that there can be, and I think you got it as well, there's a place in between. Hillary Clinton is doing this so she can run in 2012, or 2016 for that matter, and she's doing it for totally selfless reasons. I mean, I think you have it right that she's doing it because she thinks, you know, maybe she can be great. And you can be great in the context of an administration. You can do great things. You can broker great deals. You can be an important part of rebuilding America's reputation. You can have more fun than being a junior senator without jurisdiction over any relevant issue. So I think that's there. The one thing I'll say on Hillary is that she's the only one of the appointments that I really didn't like. And I didn't like it for this reason. I think she may do a great job. I wouldn't argue that. And I think maybe he made a wise political choice in choosing her. These people are smarter than me about politics. But I think campaigns should matter.
I don't think he made a wise choice, but putting it aside,
I think campaigns should matter. And what we basically tell people is that the way we will make decisions as a democracy is that leaders will come on the TV or to your town or on the internet or whatever, and they will tell you certain things, and they will give you an impression of them, and that will be the information you use to make a vote. And the information people in the primary used to make the vote, a non-substantial portion of them, was that Barack Obama thought Hillary Clinton's foreign policy judgment so flawed and insufficient that you should vote, I think as Jonah Goldberg said, for a guy who was a state senator 18 months ago. And it was a fair argument, I thought. I thought he made a very fair and powerful critique of her foreign policy take. I thought, you know, Iraq and negotiations with dictators and, you know, what was it, annihilating Iran or whatever. Kyle Lieberman was there. And then he picks her. And I'm not saying that the pick is a bad pick qua government, but I think that it does raise this question that you often get, I think, in democracy, and it's particularly in this one where the media has decided that campaigns don't matter, and so it won't pretend they do or try to hold people's feet to the fire on them. But a lot of the people I knew who supported Obama felt, like my mother and others, felt very betrayed. And I thought they were right to do so, and I think it's a shame when politicians sort of invalidate central portions of their campaign. Not to say there aren't ways of reconciling what Clinton believed and Obama believed. They're arguably not that far apart, but I think in a general sense that it was a sort of symbolic gesture that, you know what I said there doesn't matter. And I think it should. And this isn't about Obama alone. It's about sort of more broadly how we treat campaigns as sort of just a malleable competition that shouldn't really have much of a connection to governance. And I think that that has sort of worrying implications for how we make democratic decisions. And it's a shame we sort of give it such a pass.
I think, yeah, that's a really interesting point. I mean, because I think one of the things you're saying is that it promotes cynicism about rhetoric during campaigns, right? And the interesting thing about that is that Obama was supposed to be... If you what?
If I were more concise and eloquent, I would have said that.
Well, I have the benefit of being an interpreter after the fact. Okay. But Obama, it's sort of a funny thing because... you know, my father, for example, is a very political guy, and we talk politics a lot, but my family is very conservative, and he's a big McCain guy, but still is. We share a car, and I drive it around, and it's the McCain-mobile, and I feel like such a loser in Washington. I can't tell you, Washington voted 93% for Obama. I'm like that tool driving around in my McCain car still. but, you know, he said that one of the things that he liked about Obama, and it sort of wasn't Obama, but it was the phenomenon of Obama, was that Obama, that he just, something about him, the hope thing is sort of cheeseball as he thought it was, and he was one of these guys who, like, wanted to put a fear not hope bumper sticker on his car also, you know, but that it did, he also hates cynicism in politics, and he thought to the extent that Obama and the Obama phenomenon really did seem to be making people believe that there was a place in politics for them again, that it was worth engaging in democratic politics, and that it kind of Obama, like, unlocked some of these hallmark emotions of, like, believing in a politician and not being so jaded and cynical about what everything that politicians say is a lie and the political process locks everyone out, blah, 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 that was great about Obama. And then, so you're saying, you know, that the pick, it doesn't necessarily totally, it does, I mean, it undermines it a little. It reminded me a little bit, actually, Barack Obama in some of the things that he's stated about Hillary when he picked her. It was like a little bit reminiscent of Mitt Romney, which is a totally horrifying thing to say. But I remember when Romney, you remember at the end of the primary, Romney and McCain were like, they just had this sort of palpable distaste and disgust for each other. They had these debates, and they were like, you lie to the American people. No, you lie to the American people. You're full of crap, etc. And talking about how each one wanted to lose in Iraq, etc. And then Romney dropped out, and of course, I find him like a groveling opportunist, and it's just my opinion, but within weeks, you know, it had become clear to him that it was in his interest to back McCain strongly at this point for his own future, etc. And he went on TV, and he was said that compared to Hillary and Obama, John McCain is the big dog, and they're the chihuahuas. And it was like, it was this kind of funny thing about it, I laughed out loud, was that it was so discordant with what he had said during the campaign. It was that same phenomenon. And you just kind of sighed, and you were like, well, that was all that kabuki ritual of, you know.
That's politics, right?
Right, so.
And the media is complicit here, right? The media has a sort of insidery, oh, we all know this is all
complicit?
Crap, you know. Huh? Oh, complicit? More than
us?
That, right?
Us?
The media has
we're
this this whole, like, oh, yeah, well, we're insiders. We've been around this block. We know the campaigns are meaningless. We know that when you talk about, you know, NAFTA in Ohio, it's just some bullshit. We know. And, like, you know, there are certain things that they've decided they know and have decided they know well enough that they refuse to – they'll both sort of just – because it's how things work, they'll just sort of play along, or they'll, like, evince some skepticism when they're, you know, on the news. But they don't sort of hold anybody's feet to the fire. Like, they'll ask a question at the press conference, well, didn't just a few months ago you call him a mongrel lying opportunist? And then a guy would be like, oh, but, you know, like, I didn't mean that as the heat of the campaign. People say things. I'm like, oh, of course they do. I know how it is. And,
You're the naive,
you know, I'll never forget.
Ingenue reporter if you think otherwise, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, it sort of always reminds me of Stewart on Crossfire. And he's saying, you know, after debates, where do you go? And Tucker Carlson sort of, like, smugly says, the bathroom. And then he says, no, you go to Spin Alley. You literally go to a place called, like, Bullshit Lane. And, like, don't you think that's a bummer for your audience? And, like, I always get that feeling, like, look, like, I'm not particularly naive about politics, or maybe I am, and, like, I'm not shocked by this movement. And I've sort of always thought in ways that began to comfort me about him that Obama's a usefully cynical politician. But it's a bit of a bummer, I think, when I was like, ah, he named Hillary Clinton. Brilliant political judgment. It just undercuts everything he said, but whatever. And again, like, I don't want to beat too much up on this one example. I don't think Hillary Clinton will do a bad job. I don't think there's necessarily a literal contradiction. She will, at the end of the day, be carrying his priorities out. On the other hand, she will be staffing the agency, the very people he attacked her for elevating in her career. That's the sort of judgment that will be deciding who works at state, who is the next generation of Democratic foreign policy professional, on and on. But I still think she could do a fine job. This really isn't about how state will be run. I just think that as a general thing, it's really a shame, and there's sort of been this professional decision to just, like, not worry about that sort of thing. Like, Tim Russert will spend the weekends, or actually, maybe rest in peace, David Gregory will spend the weekends, God, it's funny how much he really was a sort of, like, part of the mental landscape. We'll spend the weekends popping up on the, you know, on the Sunday show saying, in 1937, when you were four, Mr. McCain, you said the taxes were awesome. Or I guess nobody said awesome then. You said they were hep. And, you know, and, like, how is that? Isn't that really different now? But that, you know, they may, like, sort of gesture towards, isn't this weird? But they won't press on it. It's not a gotcha, because, of course, they were lying about that. While, you know, things they voted for 15 or 20 years ago, their positions changed, that's a lie that can't be countenanced. And it's sort of a weird and very very opaque distinction to be making, and it's sort of one that you're like, only, you know, that you sort of get the sense that people make, but like it's not in any particular journalism rule book. But you could really have imagined a sort of like a press look at this. It was like, Obama picks former rival. Makes no sense. If you believe everything he said, huge battles to follow within the administration. But, you know, he didn't. It probably won't happen that way. A lot of campaigns are full of lies. It's just sort of a bummer.
it's kind of sucks, right?
Kind of sucks. This will be called, undoubtedly, Blogging Heads 20-somethings Political Cynicism Edition.
Right. This is a hep dialogue with you, Ezra.
Speaking of things I'm cynical about, Carolyn Kennedy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know. You're cynical. What do you mean by that?
I thought we were getting away from dynastic politics. I think it's really weird. Carolyn Kennedy should be senator because she's the daughter of somebody named Kennedy. And, like, meanwhile, you've also heard that Ted Kennedy wants his wife, Vicky Kennedy, is that right?
Victoria Reggie, yeah.
Victoria Reggie, to be named in a Senate seat. I just find all this pretty distasteful. The idea that, you know, and I was reading a New York Times article on it over the weekend, and somebody, I forget which organization, but some sort of women in politics organization had endorsed one of the contenders for the seat. And they said, oh, if Carolyn Kennedy came in, we'd really have to rethink that. But, like, why? Like, why rethink the endorsement of a longtime legislator who's been working all of her life to figure out how to be effective in government because you know Carolyn Kennedy's name? It just seems very weird to me. And, like, and not the sort of thing that's particularly healthy for the country. I guess Kennedy would have to run in elections and so forth, so maybe it's all fine. But, and again, it just seems a little bit strange.
It's so weird. I mean, it's, you know, it's like marching a tiny bit along the spectrum that leads you to have Caligula pointing his horse to the Senate. I mean, you know, like, there should be qualifications, you know. And I know this is an appointment, but there's so many, you know, so many people from other families who are qualified. It's a state with a very deep Democratic political bench. Mm-hmm. So is Massachusetts. To me, the Victoria Reggie thing is worse. Now, I don't want to impugn the wishes and the motivations of Ted Kennedy, who we respect in many ways and who we hope a speedy recovery, etc. But, you know, people should not be able to hand-select their own successors. You know, it's one thing, like, it doesn't seem like Hillary has any role or interest in Caroline Kennedy in particular or whatever. So that's a little
bit
more like that.
Not if she endorsed Obama.
True, right. She hates the Kennedys.
I'm sure Hillary Clinton has no love for Caroline Kennedy.
No. This is so terrible. I have a conservative friend who has a theory. Clinton enemies are falling ill in like a supernatural way. It's totally horrible, but it's like,
yeah,
it's
you're
just
right. That is a weird theory.
I know it's really weird, but it just shows you this person is intelligent person. Otherwise, the derangement that this political family still provokes and. And now she's going to be back in the executive office, as we talked about. I'm so pleased. But, no, Caroline Kennedy, I think, and who knows what will end up happening with the Massachusetts Senate seat. Hopefully we won't have to cross that bridge. But but the idea, you know, there's something like, it's like a sort of dictatorship where you groom and hand-select your own successor, right, who's your spouse. And I know that that's been done. Just the fact that there are some precedents for it in the House, Mary Bono or whatever, doesn't mean that that it's a cool thing. And the Kennedys, I mean, give someone else a chance. That's all I
it's
can
not
say.
Their seat. It's weird. It's not their seat. And the other side of it that pisses me off. And actually, this goes more for Carolyn than Victoria, because my understanding is that Victoria's actually had a very heavy role in running Ted Kennedy's Senate office in recent years, as he got older. That's what I know. But government and legislating are skills. They are like being a surgeon, being a good CEO of a company, being a editor at a magazine. They are things that, in theory, you should learn how to do, and you take apprenticeships, and you start at lower rungs on the ladder. Obviously, that's not always the case. Many businessmen are elected. Many of them are quite good. I think Bloomberg has been a very good governor. But there is a sort of a distaste for expertise in government, which I think is a shame and problematic. Good legislators, and I think this is something Ted Kennedy's life has proven, can get a lot done. I mean, he has really worked at understanding the literal art of legislation, the craft of legislation. I mean, he has spent decades amassing seniority and jurisdiction and relationships and a deep, deep understanding of parliamentary maneuvering and a real great sort of comprehension of constituent service and the whole of what it means to be a legislator, really a professional legislator. And he's been good because of it, and his people and the nation, his constituents and the nation have been helped by it. And Carolyn Kennedy, as far as I know, has none of that. And meanwhile, people
she
who are
could
in the
be.
Do,
it's like with Hillary and Secretary of State. You know, she could be great, right? But
right, she could be great. No,
we're
I
a huge
be,
country.
I wouldn't say not. We're a big country, and I mean, yeah, I'd like to see. There are a lot of people too with relevant experience. I mean, one interesting side note is, boy, oh boy, does Elliot Spitzer have to be kicking himself for getting caught with a prostitute a few months ago? I mean, if there was a time for Elliot Spitzer, it has been this year. And this guy, I mean, whether he'd be governor or whether he'd have the Senate
That's
seat or
true.
Whatever would happen, I mean, a Wall Street crisis with their chief antagonist, he would be just a shoo-in, an obvious choice, but either for governor or maybe Senate or president or something. But it ain't going to be him. And so instead, we're sort of like wandering around in the morass here, and Carolyn Kennedy. I mean, it's all a little bit strange.
Yeah, did you read, I don't know if you read the Frank Rich column, it wasn't at all anything about Caroline Kennedy, but it was this Sunday. It was sort of provocative. It was interesting on Barack Obama's appointments and how we're all talking about how they're the best and the brightest, and how, as happens, this is a phenomenon, over the years have sort of brought a layer of dust and a loss of the context and the understanding behind the title of that David Halberstam book, The Best and the Brightest, which is a sort of sneering book, and it has like a sneering tone. You know, they thought they were the best and the brightest, these Ivy guys, and in fact they screwed everything totally to hell regarding Vietnam. This was the Kennedy cabinet. But one thing that I think Frank Rich ended the column by quoting someone in Halberstam's book, and I forget who it is, but it was somebody on Capitol Hill or something, and Lyndon Johnson was saying that he was talking to this guy, this politician, I wish I remember.
Russell.
Yes, okay. And he was saying, raving about all of Kennedy's appointments. And this guy, Russell, I guess, replied, "Well, that's all very nice. I'm glad they have such pedigrees, but I just wish that one of them had run for sheriff once." And, I kind of feel the same way about people like Caroline Kennedy, people like Terry McAuliffe running for Virginia governor.
Right.
Now, Terry works in politics. It's not like he was just a star because of his name, or somebody like Franken. But just wattage, I think it's easy to sort of forget. It seems like such an obvious statement, but like sheer galactic wattage is not the same thing as power in Washington, or ability to leverage and manipulate the instruments of power to your will. And I was always kind of struck by the fact that, and now he's gone, but for a long time, even recently, until he left the Senate, really one of the most powerful people in the Senate was Trent Lott. And this was after he had his, like, PR meltdown, if you recall, with Strom Thurmond. And he had no celebrity. His Wikipedia page was a travesty. I mean, it was basically about how he's this horrible racist. Like, you know, he wouldn't seem like someone who would have a lot of influence. B, he's has a toupee that's like a preserved ferret from the 19th century. You know, like, he's not an attractive, you know, he doesn't have this any kind of star. But he was just, they selected him even despite his reputation, his blow to his reputation for whip again, because He was a master of the Senate, and he knew how to leverage relationships in that body to achieve what he wanted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you need all kinds of people who have all kinds of philosophies of and talents to use power in a body like the Senate. But you know, I wish they would appoint someone who would run for sheriff once to the New York and the Massachusetts seat if it comes open. I mean, why Caroline yeah. Kennedy? And I also don't understand, like, where's the outrage on Caroline Kennedy? I just think this is like, come on, you know? But this is just rolling forward. I seem to be the only person who's having just thinks this is, you know, why are we doing this? And it's like, I don't want to impugn Caroline or her role in the Obama campaign. But I read that, you know, that she wanted ambassador to the UN, but...
Why, she really shouldn't have that goddamn job.
No, I know. It was like she was looking over these jobs like they were in a window. She was window shopping these jobs. Maybe ambassador for the UN. Perhaps I could be attorney general.
As if it's like what Angelina Jolie is doing as UN's goodwill ambassador. Like, ambassador to the UN...
It's Bono politics.
Exactly how familiar do we really think Caroline Kennedy is with, like, theories of multipolarity?
This is all crazy. Bono's fault.
Yeah, well, screw Bono.
This is all Bono.
He's
going to
be on the New York Times op-ed page next
I blame
year,
Bono.
Presumably on Blocking Heads shortly thereafter.
Right.
Look, I mean, I hear what you're saying. Incidentally, I thought Frank Rich's column, I read it in prep for our Blogging Heads, had this sort of weird habit of contradicting itself one paragraph after another. The points
Frank
he was
Rich
making
column.
About it would be good if some of these people had, like, experience in the real world. Well, like, actually, and he makes his point that the thing about the folks in The Best and the Brightest is that they really understood what had gone wrong, what they had done wrong afterwards, which is essentially the argument of all these people going into the Obama campaign, that they or the Obama administration. They see the mistakes of the 90s and the early aughts, and they know how to fix them. So I don't know if that will be correct, but actually what Obama is doing is getting the people who have, like, lived through the testing rather than the people who will be sort of like the early stars of the next generation, and I think it sort of makes sense. We'll see if it works out, but I don't think what you can say is that he's just got a bunch of whiz kids there. He's got as far as I can tell, is selected precisely for the most government experience you can possibly have, the most relevant experience, which is not what Kennedy and his folks were doing, and so not what Clinton did.
Right.
As for what we do with elected office, I mean, I don't know. I'm hoping. I'd love to see how Frank can take the seat, and I actually think he'd be better than Norm Coleman, despite the fact that Norm is a much more experienced government guy. So it shows that this line of analysis only goes so far. But yeah, I mean, I think there's something basically seedy about it. And one interesting thing, and this I guess would be my last point on it, I'm surprised Caroline Kennedy doesn't think that. I'm surprised Caroline Kennedy doesn't survey the scene and say, you know what, like, that would seem a little bit weird, wouldn't it, if I became UN ambassador? Or that would seem a little bit weird, wouldn't it, if I was appointed senator from New York? If Kennedy said, like, listen, I want to run for Senate, I'm going to gear up, and in 2000, and I think it's 12 would be when that seat would come open. You know, I'm going to run,
yeah.
I'm going to fight, and I have a great Rolodex, and people donate money to me, and, like, we're going to make this happen. It's going to be great. I mean, I guess power to her, it's not, I probably wouldn't, like, think she's the one, she wouldn't be the one I would support in the primary were I a New Yorker, but that's the way you do it. But the idea that she doesn't see sort of anything weird about just being appointed to it strikes me as sort of strange and lacking in a certain self-consciousness about, you know, what it really means to be a Kennedy and what that really does or does not entitle you to.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. On the other hand, like, the whole universe of possibilities and what kind of things land in your lap and what you do or don't have to work for in traditional ways that she grew up in is, like, so totally different from the one that you and I grew up in. I mean, it's like we are ourselves both quite privileged people, but she is just on this, like, frequency way above that. And maybe she just doesn't think it's weird. You know, she had her run. She became involved in politics, sort of, so to speak, or she touched the hem of politics' garment this year on Obama's campaign. And, you know, it's also like it would be a lot damn harder to run for it when she could just be appointed. I think there's a lot of times that things are weird or uncomfortable and that are being offered to you on a platter, and you you get over the discomfort when you realize that, like, this is a freaking great opportunity if it's what you want to do, you know? So,
right. And that's
you know,
it's a very human reaction she has.
If she was a holy, you know, kind of reverer of democratic ideals and wanted to, you know, above all preserve the democratic fabric of, but that's not what the Kennedy family's totally about.
Well, at least wasn't what it was supposed to be about.
Right.
Anyway.
We should be wrapping up, but I did want to ask you before we sign off, just curious, you know, we started the conversation talking about, you know, implicit promises to liberals, unfulfilled or fulfilled, or, you know, are we disappointed yet, or do we think we are going to be disappointed, et cetera. I wonder what campaign promise Barack Obama made that you hope he does not keep.
All right, that I hope he does not keep. Man, when we thought of that question, I totally meant to prepare an answer to it.
You're in the hot seat. I can go first.
I am in the hot seat. Why don't you go first, and let me think for a second.
The one I thought of, and a friend of mine asked me this question, so I was thinking about it a little bit, too, because, you know, I thought it was sort of interesting, was just one example of that is I kind of don't hope that he keeps, and I don't want to be called a genocidaire thanks to this, but I don't necessarily hope that he keeps...
I don't even know that word to call you.
It's French, sorry. I'm an elitist, what can I say? I kind of hope that he doesn't keep, or at least doesn't keep right away, his promise to recognize the Armenian genocide.
Uh-huh.
So, it's probably going to make me seem like a horrible person, but
well,
no, you know...
I agree with you. I think that's symbolic. I think symbolism can be important, but it's a fight that does not seem to me to be the most pressing thing in the world for anybody to pick.
No, and saw the fight in this, you know, they had this fight already when Pelosi floated that idea.
Right.
It showed that it was going to take a huge amount of political capital to do. There's something a little grotesque about doing it, you know, about putting all this political capital into putting the U.S. government's stamp on this old genocide. And I understand that the kind of symbolism of government pronouncements is important, but while, like, genocides are ongoing where people are still being killed and nothing is being done about those, right? I mean, there's something a little bit crazy about that. And, you know, I think I just would say last, you know, you see, I'm not a huge expert on the politics of that region, but I follow Turkish politics a little bit. And my impression is there's a little bit of a thaw from their own government and sort of the younger generation there in approaching this. They're a little bit more willing to make concessions as far as recognizing they did something bad goes. You know, I believe that the premiers of each country went to a soccer game recently together, and this was some huge breakthrough. So it's like...
Turkey's really important. Like,
wait. Turkey's really important.
Turkey's really important. They're stepping into the Israel-Syria stuff. Like,
right.
Calm down.
Right.
I'm going to give you a political bank shot in. I mean, I could give you something obvious like ethanol. I hope he doesn't, you know, subsidize ethanol or coal. I hope he'll stay away from clean coal.
Right.
But I feel like those aren't that great. So what I will say is I hope he does not appoint a director of the Agricultural Department, and I hope he does not appoint a USDA director. I would like to see those departments dissolved. And I think they're outdated.
Sounding crazy.
Yeah, I'm talking crazy, right?
You're talking like one of those like crazy Republicans who's like, abolish every department.
you should reconstruct it, right? The Agricultural Department made a lot of sense when it was created in the late 1800s. Lincoln was the one who Lincoln first created it, and then Cleveland, I think, raised it to cabinet level. And back then, I mean, agriculture was our prime export, and it was everything we ate was agriculture. I mean, it was essentially, you know, like meat or fruits or vegetables, and I guess you had some grains. And it made sense, but now the Department of Agriculture essentially acts as this place where basically, like, a special interest comes to, like, feed at the public trout and screw up our food policy. And I would like to see, like, I mean, Department of Food is probably the wrong way to put it, but some sort of better coordinating agency that had a more coherent mission than just sort of supporting farmers. Because, you know, and Michael Pollan made this point well before, that you would want to have the interests of essentially eaters, not just producers represented. And you want to think about, do we want to be subsidizing high fructose corn syrup? I mean, what is the nutritional outcome of that? And sort of on and on and on. I'd like to see them rethink that position. This will not happen, but it would be nice if it did.
Well, I would nominate
and
you
on that
for
bit of political fancy.
Department of Food for...
Yeah, you need a better name.
Anyone who doesn't know out there, Ezra's a phenomenal cook. And he has as much experience as Caroline Kennedy, and there are other politicians out there named Klein. Ergo, Ezra Klein for Department
Ezra
of
Klein
Eaters.
For Secretary of Food,
yeah.
Secretary
yeah.
of Eating.
Yeah.
I have run a food blog, which is more than many of the others can say. Anyway, now that we've gotten into total fancy, we should probably end it here.
Yep, my phone is ringing also. Great to catch up with you, and ciao.
Cheers, Eve.
Bye-bye.